Hey friends, Devin again for the Bardic Babble podcast, a show where we talk to creators about the things that they create. On today's episode, we have the lead designer for a brand new system called Perilous. Perilous is a GM-less tabletop RPG system that operates with a deck of cards and some keywords, or tags as I like to call them. It's a beautiful system, the artwork is amazing, and community is at the heart of the system. So if you're looking for something a little new, head on over to Kickstarter. You can find that by Tabletop Crow or by Perilous RPG. And as always, wherever you're finding the podcast currently, please leave a rating and review. Let us know what you think of the show, how we can improve. And of course, it always helps us to get in front of more friends and more fans of tabletop RPG systems. And as you know, we're barreling closer towards election day. So everybody get out there and make sure to do your civic duty and vote. We're going to take a quick sponsored break and then we're going to dive into it with Jordan. All right. Welcome back, listeners. Today I have Jordan, you're the head designer on Perilous. This is your baby, right?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Awesome. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty good.
Awesome. So let's dive into Perilous yourself. Who are you and how did you get into tabletop?
Okay. Well, I do full-time game design mostly. I've been doing game design for about 2 years. I've been interested in making games since forever. Like, I think I had a friend who introduced me to RPGs when I was like 10, and I've been obsessed ever since. And it's kind of the thing that I've always wanted to do. So that's kind of how I got my start. My first game was For the Dungeon, which was this kind of improv, just zany, madcap, just playing the minions in a dungeon instead of the heroes.
Oh, that's awesome. So what is Perilous?
Yeah, so Perilous is basically like the fantasy game that I've kind of always wanted to play. So we did some, I'm obsessed with tags. So there's lots of that in there. I love how they just can connect like mechanics to the story and call things out. So there's a lot of that. But at its core, Perilous is this game about just tight-knit communities that are spread out. And because I wanted to kind of have tell the story where you don't have, because you have these classic like murder hobos that, you know, no home, no attachments. And I really wanted to get away from that. So the game assumes like you have a community that you're really close to and you are out adventuring because you want to help them. And so Perilous is the world of just these small, tight-knit communities that are scattered throughout the world. Basically, dungeons are places of just ancient magic where it started to decay, causing all kinds of weird quirks and anomalies. And so people have set up shop in dungeons. They've set up communities in dungeons to take advantage of these quirks. And so you, as the adventurer, your job is to go off, explore dungeons, find magic, and bring it back because it can help people.
Very cool. You mentioned tags. Can you expand on those a little bit?
Yeah. So tags are just like short phrases that call attention to the important details in any given scene. So if the room was on fire, you might have a tag that was just on fire. And that says that this narrative detail has mechanical weight. And so it's just little things, little phrases that tie together the mechanics to what's going on in the story.
Very cool. At the heart of the system, are we looking at, is it D20? Is it D6? What kind of mechanics are we looking at there?
It uses a D20. So basically the way it works is you've got a set of aspects, which are just short phrases chosen from a list about who your character is. So the kind of magic they know, their signature equipment that they use, the skills that they have, their motivations and personality, all these things kind of combine to represent who your character is. And so for each one of those, you get bonuses to your role that you can apply. So if you were particularly athletic, then you get bonuses to, you know, climbing and running and jumping or whatever. And so you roll the die and then you compare it to a set list. It's got successes, partial successes, failures, and then you just choose the consequences based on what fits most in the scenario.
Very cool. So now I am looking at your Kickstarter. Congrats on hitting the goal in the first hour there. That's awesome.
Thanks.
So I'm seeing GM optional. You don't need a GM to play Perilous?
No. So I just lately, especially with, so basically as I'm doing a lot of game design, I'm usually running the games. And so I really wanted to make a game where you didn't have to have a GM, where everybody could just come together. You don't need anybody to run the game. You don't need any prep to happen. You can just sit down and do it. And so I've been working with Spencer Stark to make a deck that runs the game for you, what kind of acts as the GM. And so basically how it works is there's cards with these just evocative images that the players will use as kind of inspiration to answer questions. And the questions are all on the cards, and you kind of build this scene little by little as each player plays their card and fills in the details. And then at the end, you look at all your tags and decide, okay, what are the actual challenges we're facing? And so it will come up with all these challenges on the fly completely for you.
Very cool. So one, I've actually had the chance of speaking with John and Doug with Kids on Bikes. So seeing Spencer's name pop up yet again, I love it. I can't wait to get him on the show. How was it working with Spencer, bringing him on board?
Oh, it was... He's so awesome. Just being able to bounce ideas back and forth and just having him on board to help with the GM-less design, because GM-less design isn't something that I was super comfortable with. So I was looking to branch out and have someone who definitely knows that field. And I mean, he recently had Alice is Missing, and that's just such a cool game. And so like the chance to work with him has been really cool. And just the ideas and the insight has been really helpful in creating this GM-less portion of the game.
Very cool. So what ultimately put you on the path to Perilous? Deciding to make your own game system is one thing, and then kickstarting, it's this whole other thing. Like what put you on this path?
So about 2 years ago, I had started and I had a campaign that did really successful, well beyond what I had considered. And so at that point I was like, well, maybe this is something that I can do full time. And so I've been working on that. And so Perilous in particular was the game that I've kind of always wanted to play, because I mean, a lot of people get their start in Dungeons and Dragons. But as you go on and you explore this world, you find that there are a lot of other games that you enjoy. And so I wanted to make the game that I would want to play, with just really cool. It's super easy to jump into. And so I started with Perilous kind of based off of some of my other games. And as it played, it kind of evolved and did more, especially as I started bringing in other designers to help along with the design. It changed it quite a bit. And it's so cool to see how much a game can change once it's not just one person working on it, but lots of people you're able to pull in.
Very cool. When you were a wee young tyke playing your first RPG, did you ever foresee a future where you were making games full time?
I certainly wanted that. I don't know if it was realistic. I think I started trying my hand at RPGs, and they were terrible, because, you know, you got to be bad at something before you can be good at something. And so I've been trying to design games since I was 12, just tinkering and making stuff. It's definitely my passion. And so it's what I've wanted to do for a really long time. And so being able to do it, doing something you like, is really cool. So
what is, like, when you're developing the project and everything like that, what was like the total production time that you guys spent on literally beginning to kickstarting?
Oh gosh. So it was the early idea stages, maybe somewhere between 8 and 10 months ago, is when we really started putting this together. And then just as it's gone, as I get closer and closer to completing it, I tend to put more effort into it. So this game has gotten through probably the most playtesting of any of my games. So I've been playtesting about at least once or twice a week for the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 months or so. And so it's really cool to see, like, my first playtesters when they come back to it like a month later, and they get to see all the things that's changed. But yeah, so from my idea phase was about 8 to 10 months ago, but I started getting serious and the design started solidifying probably about 4 months ago is when a lot of the core principles and core design philosophies were nailed down.
All right. Is Perilous going to be something that is an ongoing project? Are you going to develop more decks for it? Are you going to do more stories and branch out with it, or nail the coffin and move on to the next big project?
Normally I move on to other projects, but Perilous is something that I'm definitely thinking about putting more time into, especially because I've had other designers reach out and be like, hey, the system's really cool. I want to make my own game in this system. Like, how do I go about doing that? And so, like, that's something that I just hadn't even considered before, just because nobody's asked me that question. And so this idea that, like, I might have something that I can build off of, that I can add more decks, more themes, is really cool. So, like, if I wanted to throw in a new genre, like, I would know how to do that. You just change out the abilities, you change out the GM-less deck, and you've got a good start on creating something else. I also think there's a good base there to add on to. So I'd love to be making expansions for the game if possible, just kind of expanding the content or opening it up to the community and just having some kind of open license that allows other people to make content for the game.
Be cool. Has the whole COVID quarantine lockdown, has that impacted you and your team at all when it comes to production?
I mean, in some ways it was helpful because everybody's at home. And so it was a lot easier to play test because people aren't out doing stuff. In other ways, it's just stressful, you know, with everything going on. I mean, I'm just getting over COVID. So woo, fun stuff there. But I mean, so in general, hasn't been too much. But I imagine as we progress into manufacturing and fulfillment, that's the area where there's probably going to be the most impact. So
I gotcha. Are you guys looking to develop it for any of the virtual tabletop system, Roll20 or anything like that?
Yeah. So we're hoping to launch it on both Roll and Roll20 right out of the gate. And so we're working with a lot of those people on that to get that all sorted and get all the cards uploaded and assets and whatever automation is needed. I'm gonna have to bring somebody on with help with all that. But the idea is this, definitely to have this, because especially with a GM-less game, I wanted something that would have the tools built in to make it really, really easy just to pick up and play online. Because that's where I do most of my play nowadays.
Right.
I mean, especially with, you know, pandemic.
Yeah.
Yes. And so just, yes, yeah, so I really wanted to support those tools because that's where most of my gaming is nowadays.
Gotcha. And then through this entire process, what has been your creme de la creme, the cherry on top for you, your favorite thing?
I have to say it's been when the GM-less portion of the game came together. Like, it was just this moment where everything clicked, and then we tried it out, the idea, and just it took a little bit of tweaking. But once we had it, it felt so cool to explore exactly, like, step by step what that looked like and how smooth it was and how the ideas went in directions you could never predict, but still felt really cohesive. And just that moment when the GM list came together was a really, really cool moment. Like, I was so excited about it when that happened.
Nice. And then on the flip side of the same coin, what has been the most challenging aspect of the entire thing?
Oh, so for me, it's always coming up with different abilities. Like, the core of a system is always really easy for me to get into. That's the reason why I lean on tags. I cheat. It's really easy to use them, which is why I brought in some other people. So I brought in Aaron to help with some of the abilities. And so going back and forth with him on that was interesting, because it was this whole thing where coming up with new abilities for a game that was mostly there is really challenging. But it was really interesting to see, like, how the abilities affected the game and vice versa. So for example, like, as we were working on these abilities and the different powers that you'd be able to be using, we found out that, like, some of the resources were just felt weird, and so we ended up changing it. So in the game, you've got a pool of resources called your edge, which is just how you power your abilities. And the way it works is just as you build successes, you gain more edge, and then after you rest, they go away. And so it's this kind of ebb and flow of, like, gaining all these powers and then blowing them on something, a really cool ability. So that took a while to get, but now it's working really well.
Awesome. Can you dive into a few of those abilities just so we get a good feel for a few?
So basically how it works is you have these different aspects, which are just kind of like core bits of your character. So for example, one of the aspects is just having a shield. So that's a piece of your equipment that's just core to how your adventure operates. And so the shield will have abilities such as, like, being able to run in and take damage for somebody else and then reduce it because you've got a shield, and just different stuff like that. And so you're building edge as you gain successes, and then you spend them to do these really cool abilities that are just kind of iconic. And the other part of them, of the aspects, is that they are tags as well. So the tag is just literally shield. So anytime a shield comes in handy, you get your bonus. And so it's kind of nice to have these dual part abilities where you use them constantly as, like, just bonuses. And then they also provide all of your powers. And so it's really cool because, I mean, I bring up shield because everybody uses it. It's been one of the favorite abilities of everybody, just because they're like, wait, I can get bonuses for shield surfing. And then they're like, yeah, I want to do that. And so I like that it doesn't limit you to a shield can only block. You know, this is a shield. If you can use it and it will benefit you, you get the bonuses.
Gotcha. When you're going through and you're doing the designing and you're working with your team and you're ping-ponging back and forth, where do you look for inspiration? What kind of media do you like to dive into to get over a creative block or to solve a problem?
For me, it's a lot of books. I don't watch a lot of TV and movies. So a lot of it is in the books that I read. And I know that books and RPGs are very different, especially when it comes to how they portray the action. Because one, you are in the place of the person, and one is you're trying to describe it. So you have to do two very different things. But I find that the tropes are very familiar. And I mean, especially like TV tropes, I feel like nearly every ability is grounded in some trope that I found on TV tropes, just because they've got everything. And it's usually pulling inspiration just from iconic moments and what you want it to feel like is really cool. So like if you've got the giant sword as one of your aspects, you want to be able to do the things that you could do if you had a giant sword. So a lot of those moments of like just shattering through enormous things and just being somebody who can sweep through enemies is cool. And so that's how we tied all the abilities in, is we tried to be like, if I had this, what is the coolest thing I could do with it? And that's where we went.
Gotcha. Now, just to kind of dive into the more technical aspects, or continue diving into the more technical aspects of the system, just that way we get a full 360 view of it. I'm here on, I believe it's the preview. Can you dive into turns and momentum a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll just kind of go over kind of the structure of what it looks like. So you've got your personal tags, which are your aspects, which are the things like your equipment and magic, you know. So I've gone on to that a little bit. But then enemies also have their own tag. So instead of health, enemies are a collection of tags that represent what is dangerous or what is difficult about a scenario. So, for example, the room being on fire might be a tag that you have to worry about. Rocky terrain could be a tag you have to worry about. The fact that a dragon is able to fly and stay out of your reach is something you have to worry about. So you might have, like, a dragon could be a collection of like armored scales, and it has flight and it can breathe fire. And those are the three things you have to overcome instead of hitting its health. So you have to get past its armor, you have to overcome the fact that it's flying, and you have to find a way to get past its fiery breath. And so the way it works is you are diving in and you're trying to overcome those. So on a success, there are two things you can do. The first thing is you can overcome one of those if it's applicable. So for example, just to continue with the example of a dragon that can fly, you might try and, I mean, you could try and attack its wings to take it down or something like that, but you don't have, you could just as easily summon like a storm so that its flight is no longer useful. Or someone could try and lasso it and make it just less mobile so that its flight isn't useful. And so it's really cool that you can solve these, but it doesn't have to be attacking. And so those are how you overcome those challenge tags. So that's the first thing you can do. The second thing you can do is you can create these openings, these opportunities that provide bonuses. And they're kind of just, so they're team-wide. And so you're either overcoming an obstacle directly, or you're making it more likely to overcome as you build up all these opportunities. So you might, if you've got, say, ice powers, you could create a slick floor, and that would add a new tag to the scene, slick floor, that now anybody can use and take advantage of. And so it's kind of this cool balance between, do I gun straight for the abilities or straight for the challenges that I'm trying to overcome? Or do I try and set myself up first with more and more tools to use to overcome this challenge? And the nice thing there is it allows people who might be less inclined to go directly at a problem to still contribute. So they can be setting up these openings that everybody else gets to use. And it feels really cool to kind of act in a supporting role. So on your turn, as you're trying to do these things, you make a roll and then you follow it, whatever it says. So a certain amount of success, partial success, failure. If you roll below a success, though, you lose your momentum. And so momentum is kind of this back and forth of who's in control in the scene. And so everybody has their each momentum that they're doing. So if you've got the momentum, you call what you're going to do. You say, no, I'm going to try and attack the dragon, or I'm going to try and lay down cover fire or whatever. If you don't have the momentum, then on your turn, instead, the GM, or in the case of a GMless version, yourself, picks a threat in the scene and says, hey, this is coming for you. So if I had lost the momentum and I'm fighting a dragon, I might narrate, hey, a dragon is barreling towards you. You know, it's got fiery breath shooting at you. What do you do? And so your turn is spent trying to overcome this challenge instead of progressing and overcoming the challenge tags in the scene. And then every time you succeed, you roll a 15 plus, you gain it back. And so it's kind of this cool back and forth of you are always taking turns. So the enemy doesn't take any turns. But when you don't have the momentum, that's when the enemy gets to act. And there are some abilities that allow you to regain momentum and to, you know, jump back into the action to seize control back. And there's really cool moments that you can do with that to just, when you feel like you're, you know, you're getting pushed back, to kind of trigger that ability and be like, no, I'm turning the tables. Now I'm going for you instead. And so it feels really cool with the back and forth of the momentum. So another thing that I probably want to talk about is the way I handle wounds and death, because I wanted to do something really cool with death. And the way it works is there's minor and major wounds. As you take them, minor goes away whenever you rest. Major wounds stick with you until you basically head back to town. You've got safety to recover. But the way it works is when you accumulate enough of them, you take these permanent consequences. And so as you build up these consequences, your character is closer and closer to, I guess, their final adventure. So you'll build these up. You might take like a scar, like, so you might have a burn from a dragon to just dip back to the exact same well. And so this is something that sticks with you. And as you mark enough of these off, eventually there's only one option left, which is your adventure comes to an end. And so when you have to choose that option, you have two choices. You can basically go out with a bang, where you sacrifice yourself in just one moment of glory. And no matter what you say basically happens. So you overcome every possible challenge that's in that scene as you sacrifice yourself, which leads to these really, really cool just moments of glory, of like final moments where you're pulling something out to save everybody else. But not everybody wants to do that. And so the other option is, this is the final adventure. Like, you're going to retire after this. Just the fact that you've been adventuring so long, it's taken your toll on you. I mean, you can finish out the adventure, but afterwards, this is it. And your character will become an NPC that stays in the community and you can still visit and see, which allows to kind of like build the world up a little bit, which is kind of fun. And then if you die, you have one of the members of the community, like you kind of narrate them introducing you to the group and being like, hey, here's a new adventurer. Like, because it's very community focused, it's really easy to integrate somebody new. It doesn't feel like some random person dropping in on the group. It's, hey, here is someone from our community. You know me, like I'm vouching for them to be a part of your group. And I like the idea of a very close-knit group of adventurers rather than this very loose, everybody is kind of in it for themselves.
Gotcha. And then how does like the reward system, loot and all that work?
Yeah, so loot is mainly done in the form of different kinds of magic. So different kinds of artifacts and different rituals and whatever. And they're less, I mean, you can definitely use them personally. There's nothing stopping you from using them personally. But a lot of the magic items that we've included, I had Hamu help me out with that, are geared towards something that could be beneficial to a community. And so it gives this kind of balance of like, yeah, we can use it. But also if we take this back, everybody back home is going to make their lives a lot easier because of this magic. And I love the feeling of you are delving for a reason, that there is all kinds of magic tucked away in ancient dungeons that is useful to people, and that you're going in and getting the old magic so that you can help. And that feels really cool. As for advancement, there's basically two ways you can advance. So every time you take a permanent consequence, you get an advancement. So as your character gets closer to dying, they automatically get more powerful. So you'll always get to explore your abilities before you die, which is fun. The other way is you have sets of goals. Like, you might want to retrieve a powerful artifact for the community. I mean, you write down your goals like, hey, this is my iconic adventurer's journey. This is what my character wants to do as an adventurer. And as you check off those goals, you'll also gain advancements. Basically, so it's just two different ways. One, you're racing towards what is eventually you stop adventuring. And one is you're racing towards what you believe is like the iconic of an adventurer. And so those are the two ways that you're increasing and gaining new abilities. So just whenever one of those triggers, you gain a new ability from one of your aspects.
So one of the words that keeps coming up with this system is community. And then just to kind of piggyback on that, you are very active in social media, and especially on Twitter is where I found you. How has it been building yourself into the community and then a community around Perilous?
It's been really cool. So when I first started out, I was not really a huge part of any of the communities. I was just designing games for fun. And it wasn't until after, when I saw that a bunch of people liked the first game I made, where I was like, okay, wait a second. Like, I like, you know, talking to these people and being involved with them and seeing all the other games that are coming out of here. And so getting involved has been really cool, because there is a lot of cool stuff coming out in RPGs. Just like, anytime I see a new game that just kind of like pops open, I'm like, wow, I had no idea an RPG could be this. And it's really cool to kind of expand and explore that. And then specifically with Perilous, it's mainly been building a community around the playtesters. And I developed a lot of friendships with a lot of the playtesters. And it's been really cool to come back and share Perilous, share the new updates. And people will be like, oh, I remember when that was this or whatever. And in fact, a lot of the art that I have in the game was inspired by some of the early playtesters. So in the very first playtest I did, there was a goblin waffle vendor with absurdly salty waffles that they wanted to help out. And just, they were so endeared to this character that he ended up getting included in the game as some of the art. And it was really cool to kind of see those people talk about. And so even today, people from that playtest will talk about the salty waffles or the goblin vendor. And it's really cool just to kind of see this kind of build up around your game.
That's cool. And then you get the inside stories that become everybody's inside stories. That's fun. So now, when you were looking for team members to bring on, when you were looking to, you know, seek out help, how did you find the individuals that you brought on?
Most of it was just recommendation from friends on and any people I mutuals on Twitter, where I'd reach out and be like, hey, here's an aspect that I'm working on. Do you know anyone who's really good at this, who would really excel and kind of round this out? Which was awesome, because like, I'm terrible at making abilities or fleshing out like the nitty gritty details of settings. And so having Aaron come in and help me with the ability, someone had recommended him to me, or Pamu, and they were just had so many cool ideas. They had made me a big list of like 100 different dungeon concepts. And like just looking through it, I was like, this is like such a cool just source of inspiration for like what random quirk does this dungeon have that we're about to explore? And those areas that I have no strengths in. And so Perilous in particular, as I've been pulling people, has become a lot better of a game. But yeah, everybody's basically just been a recommendation from somebody that I trust. And it's been awesome, which is why community building is really probably so important, is because as you make these connections, you'll be able to reach out and work with other designers, and they're going to make your game so much better because of it.
Gotcha. Now, the next question I want to ask pertains to, you know, mental health and neurodiversity and things like that. I just want to okay with you before I dive into it.
Cool.
So just looking on your Twitter, Jordan Makes Games, Tabletop Crow, one of the things that I notice on here is ADHD and autism. How has it been designing and working through the nightmare that is quarantine with ADHD and with autism?
Oh, I mean, in particular, ADHD and just sticking to schedules and kind of being all over the place is a mess. And so, I mean, it helps that I'm doing this full time. I do not think I could maintain making games with a full-time job. I mean, I could, but it'd take me 2 to 3 years to put out a game instead of, you know. And so things that I've really had to do is, I mean, my wife is so used to me just being like, hey, I have an idea. I have to get it out of my head, like right now, because I have a really hard time sticking to a schedule. And so being able to, whenever I've got an idea, whenever I've got the motivation to jump in and just allowing myself to not feel like I have to stick to a strict schedule has really helped. And I still try. Like I still sit down, you know, every morning for a few hours just so that I can get in the habit of, well, building the habit of working on stuff. But also I don't hold myself too strictly to that. I let myself, you know, kind of work whenever I'm feeling motivated instead of feeling like I have to push myself. So if I'm hitting my head against a wall, sometimes I have to dip out and just be like, I'm not being productive right now. I've got to do something else. And so a lot of the best design work is when I'm not expecting something to come up, when I'm not, you know, trying to push myself, but I'm just kind of idly tinkering or idly writing stuff in a notebook. And then something strikes and I'll be like, no, I got to go sit down for an hour and get this in paper.
Gotcha. Now, you talked about, you know, running into a wall and hitting your head against a wall. When you run into those moments, what helps you to get back into a good mental health space to, you know, just get your mind separated from work? What do you like to do on the side?
I have a terrible habit of monetizing all my hobbies. So yeah, I mean, at this point, I'm a little bit of a Swiss Army knife of abandoned hobbies, but I'll pick up something new, something different, just because I have a hard time and I never stick with it. But it's in the meantime, I guess. But whenever I'm hitting a point where I just cannot progress and it's just I'm not being productive, I really just have to get my headspace. A lot of times it's out of that project, but a lot of times it's just out of game design in general. So I'll read a book, I'll play a video game instead of a board game or what have you. But 90% of the time, it's me picking a different project up. What I'll find is I get really excited with a project and then I'll just focus on that exclusively. And then like a month or two in, I'm burnt out and I've got like a million other ideas. I'm like, oh, but these are cool. And I have to go explore those. And so jumping between projects has been pretty helpful. One, because it keeps me, I guess, a little bit more fresh for when I come back to my projects. And two, it's really cool to be able to go back to your design folder and just pull up and be like, oh, here are all these ideas. Because nothing's ever really wasted. There's always something like Perilous's jumble of like 4 or 5 different game ideas that I've had over the years kind of meshed together. And so it's been helpful to just work on a different project. And it's okay if that project isn't, and I know I said I have a bad habit of monetizing hobbies, but I have to be okay with like, hey, this project will never see the light of day, but working on it's fun. So, and I'm engaged and I'm motivated. So let's put my effort there. And maybe eventually it'll be something that I can use. And if not, that's all right.
Gotcha. Very cool. So representation is something that we're seeing more and more of in the tabletop RPG space, especially when it comes to, you know, varying ethnicities and especially with neurodivergencies. Before this newfound fresh wave of it in 2020, did you ever find like layout and design or like the density and crunchiness of Pathfinder or D&D to be a dissuasive factor in you playing or picking up tabletop RPGs?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, well, yes and no. I'd find it'd be hard until I was able to have somebody kind of explain it to me and walk through. And then after that point, once I got past this initial barrier of like, I don't get the system or I don't get these. And once I get past that, I find myself just focusing and delving down that hole. But that first little like 20% of understanding was so hard. And so I found like, as soon as I started finding like Powered by the Apocalypse games, which was huge, it opened it up because it felt a lot more approachable. Everything I need to know is on one character sheet. And that was really easy for me to get into. And so it kind of opened this idea of like, I really want to make games that you can jump into really easily. And so Perilous in particular, I've laid it out in a way that hopefully is really easy to get into. I mean, the layout is very open. And especially with, was it Quest? When I saw the layout Quest, like I was looking, I was like, oh, this is, it feels so light and airy. And it was really easy to read because, you know, one page was just one concept and that was it. And so examples like those and applying them to my designs is kind of helped. And then one thing that I'm playing more and more with is external tools. So one thing that I plan on doing before the book is released is to record myself talking through the system, just kind of like, hey, here's how you play, and just include just like a QR link directly into the book. It's like, hey, if you've got trouble with, you know, reading and understanding and just picking it up, you can have somebody explain it to you verbally and just walk you through it. Because that's always been easiest for me, is somebody explaining the game rather than me trying to read it. Just because the concepts don't always make sense until I see them in play or I see someone else explain it in just natural language. So that's something that I'm trying, is including external tools for like, hey, if you want to learn about more about safety tools, here's a QR code, go off, learn something. Or hey, if you want to see me explain this video, here's a QR code, go off, and you can do these, and just including them right in the book with the links to, you know, kind of make it a lot easier and more approachable for everybody, no matter how you kind of pick up and learn things.
Very cool. Very cool. I really like that. You know, thank you for taking the extra couple of steps when it comes to those kinds of things. The easier and more accessible, the wider the audience, the more people we bring into the hobby. I like that. So that's really all the questions that I had written down to really dive into, but I'm on your itch.io, and I kind of just want to talk about For the Dungeon, Mage Against the Machine, and Arcana Academy. Do you just want to take a couple minutes, talk about each one?
Yeah, sure. So For the Dungeon is by and far my most popular game. Like, everybody who's played it has said like, wow, this was a ton of fun. And a lot of that is because I've been stealing and borrowing from improv principles. So all my playtesters were in a college improv group. And so a lot of it is just based in these principles of improv, but made in a more approachable way. So For the Dungeon, what it is, it's just a really, really basic stripped down apocalypse engine. But then I've also added in a way to critically fail. And when you critically fail, you provide just a one word prompt to the GM and they just make whatever happen based upon it. So, you know, they're like, pond, and you're like, there's a 20-pound koi fish coming for it. Anyways. And so it's just this very zany, all over the place game that is caught on because it's so easy to pick up. I run an RPG club in a middle school, and that's always a favorite just because of how easy it is. So yeah, I'll start with that one just because that's the one. Arcana Academy was kind of my take at the magic school mystery genre, and it's very much focused on the mystery itself. And so there's a very specific structure that the GM has to follow, where they have some question and they don't reveal what that question is to the players, and that's the mystery. And as the players go through, they collect these clues that allow them to ask any question they want. And then as they ask these questions, eventually they'll stumble upon the question that the GM is not allowed to answer, which is the mystery. And he says, hey, this is the mystery. This is what you're ultimately going towards. And now they have to use those questions to get closer to the answer, but they can't ask the question directly because the GM will never answer it. And then the third stage is after they figure out what the answer is, they've got to resolve it. And so it's kind of this cool thing of like, and all the consequences that the GM has, he creates a custom consequence for each mystery that's kind of there to guide you towards it. So if your fellow students are going missing in a specific thing, then you're naturally going to gravitate towards that area to help you find the clue. So it's really about just solving the mystery and using the unique spells that each person has to solve it. And then Mage Against the Machine was that one I did for Zion Quest. So I let myself be a little bit more weird with that one. It's a GM-less game about wizards going back in time to stop the robot apocalypse.
All right. And I like that.
Yeah, no, honestly, the name came before any of the game did. I just like, oh, Mage Against the Machine. How can I turn that into a game now? And so it's basically just wizards. And so each person has memories in time that are linked to moments that led to the robot apocalypse. So they have to go back and either find out how this event started or figure out how, like, so you'll know either how it started or how it ended. So if you know how an event started, you don't know what happened that led to the robot apocalypse, but you know it's in this area, in this time frame, this thing happened. Or you know what happened, but you don't know how to get there. So you might know, okay, so a virus was released at this computer virus, but we don't know how it was released. And so the person whose memory it is kind of takes on the role of the GM, and they answer everybody's questions. So they're like, hey, this is my memory that I know. And they're all deeply tied to who you are. So they're tied to, like, you know, your happiest memory, the memory that brought you the most peace or what have you. And so you go into these memories and you're narrating, like, okay, here's what happened in this. And other players are going through and rolling and trying to overcome it. But as they fail, they generate anomalies. And at the end of the game, all of the anomalies have the chance to completely change your future. And so you could end up having your happy memory turn into something completely bitter and the opposite. And it's this really kind of, and sometimes they're unchanged, sometimes they just, it never happened. And then sometimes they are the exact opposite. And so watching these happy memories turn into bitter things and only you know about it is kind of had this fun little emotional punch at the end. So
that sounds incredible. I might have to pick this up. That sounds like a lot of fun. So that's all the questions that I had. Jordan, thank you so much for coming on, taking the time to talk about Perilous and all of the other games that you can find over on tabletop.itch.io. So other than the itch, where can we find you on the social media and where can we find Perilous?
So Perilous is currently on Kickstarter, obviously. On Twitter, I'm at /tabletopcrow. That's where I spend most of my time. Occasionally hang out in Facebook or Tumblr, but I don't spend as much time there. Usually Twitter, Tabletop Crow, is where you're going to find me, and I'm constantly posting about Perilous. But you can also just head to Kickstarter and search Perilous and pull it up and take a look, see if it's something you'd like.
Awesome. And then after Kickstarter, where can we find Perilous, or where are you planning to put it?
So it's definitely going to be on Itch and Roll20. I'm going to have a website eventually because I keep forgetting to make that happen. I mean, it'll be there, but Itch is probably the place where I post most of my stuff for sure. So
yeah, just for the listeners in a few months that come back after the Kickstarter has fulfilled. So again, Jordan, thank you so much. And then listeners, be sure to head on over to tabletop.itch.io, get yourself some for the dungeon, and keep your eyes out for Perilous if you can't snag it during the Kickstarter. Jordan, you have a wonderful rest of your day, and I will chat with you on Twitter in the future.
Okay, thank you.
Bardic Babble is a part of the Bard Podcast Network's family of shows. You can find Bardic Babble and all of our other shows at thebardpodcast.com. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe for updates on new episodes. We can't wait to share the next story with you.